This episode of T-Talk is brought to you by TaylorMade Sim, featuring the Sim driver designed with an entirely new head shape to make the driver both fast and forgiving where you need it most, the downswing. Sim irons with an improved speed bridge and echo damping system to deliver a distance iron with forge-like feel, and the Sim fairway woods with low CG to help you hit it higher and a V-steel sole to launch it easier from any lie. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family.
We are back on the T-Talk podcast brought to you by Flagstick.com. Quarantine season is still underway, so we're in our home studios chatting. Scotty, how are you today?
I'm doing okay, man. You?
I'm all right. I can't, you know, you can complain, but who's really listening, right?
Nobody
really.
Not much point. Much.
Exactly. So we're here. We're fighting through with everybody else. I'm thinking about moving to Arizona, though. Did you see the news out of Arizona today? Golf deemed essential in the state of Arizona.
That one was kind of surprising, so we'll see. I know there was a lot of places still playing there up to a week and a half ago, as it was, that were busy. And then we've had some mini tours that have been playing there as well. So we'll see how long that lasts.
Yeah, who knows? We're not the health experts. And you know what? We're going to try to avoid as much talk about the virus as we can this week, because, you know, as we've talked about, we're trying to bring some fun to the pot, to the world. You know, each week, at least you can know we're going to bring some sort of laughs and good golf content, not just all the depressing stuff that is out there, though. You know, you do have to talk about it. It is news.
Yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of conversation about it. I even know just being in some Zoom chats for myself last night, just with some other people, we were mostly just talking about golf. Really, I mean, impacts of COVID-19 was part of it, but in most of the cases, we're just golf people talking and then realizing, you know what, it is what it is, and we'll deal with it. And in the meantime, we certainly can talk about the sport we love.
I agree. Well, let's hop into some of the stuff from the professional tours. The PGA Tour making a little bit of news today. We are recording this on Tuesday. Usually hear this around Thursday because everyone listens right away. We know you all just can't wait till we're in your ears. Regret that wording, but I'm going to move on. The PGA Tour announced today that they've canceled events right up until Colonial, which is scheduled to be the first start. They are expanding the fields from 120 up to 144. They emailed the players. They talked about trying to create more alternate events once they actually know when the, you know, the season does start. And then they also moved their new pace of play policy to the next year. What are your thoughts on all of this? I think let's start with the expanded fields.
I think it's the adjustments they sort of have to make. I mean, everything's going to be so limited, and even talking to some LPGA players and the same sort of thing, the schedule is so going to be so concentrated if they get started on the back end that they certainly have to create as many opportunities as possible. So for the PGA Tour to do that, to allow, you know, 24 extra players in the field, they're talking about possibly not having Monday qualifying, so those spots will be guaranteed to go to the members. I think it's just the right things that they'll have to do for their membership so that they can have the most opportunity possible.
I agree. Did they say anything about the cut, though? Because the cut this year, they obviously brought down to the top 65 in ties, right? So, you know, you're expanding the field to 144. Is the cut going to be, you know, bigger, or have they mentioned anything along those lines?
No, they haven't even mentioned it yet. I mean, really, the news that's come out is mostly come from the players, come from that side of it. It's tour notification to the players. They haven't officially put it on their website or anything yet. So, you know, we'll get those details. I could see them, you know, kind of rescinding those shorter, tighter cuts and then having, you know, more available. It's hard to know. They've got a lot of stuff that they've got to think about right now. And all that, of course, is, you know, depending on if they get started when they're hoping to.
Absolutely. Now, moving on to the alternate events stuff, I think this is actually a great idea. And maybe, you know, this is a blessing in disguise. Maybe we turn into, you know, the PGA Tour turns into a tour that has multiple alternate events. Even on weeks that are just standard invitational weeks, maybe this, you know, shows that there isn't a want for it, a need for it. What are your thoughts on creating the more alternate events?
I don't know. I don't know where I sit on that one. I mean, the schedules are so packed as it is. It's hard to know when there's sort of gaps. I think they're going to have to realize now, though, that having so many events, especially PGA Tour has 48 events. in total, and that includes opposite field events. They definitely are trying to create more opportunities for their members, but on the other side of it, having no space between the events doesn't leave much room if something like this happens.
I do wonder though, like if you think of the guys that, you know, this was their only year of status, and maybe, you know, people where this could, where their status could potentially wrap up, you know, do they look at this year and say, you know, that's it, like that you got your year, whether it was a condensed year or not, or are they going to, do they look to switch it? Do they expand the year? Do they push everything back here and the rewind season starts in, say, February instead of September, right? Like who really knows? But that those are those guys that are on the bubble already. They got to be wondering this for sure.
Well, I think for the players that actually, you know, got out and played in the early events, they're at a certain advantage at this point. For the players that weren't going to get access to the events, they probably weren't necessarily going to get a lot of access anyways, but it limits how much they can, you know, how much they can make. They're going to have to do it in a shorter period of time. The tour is obviously going to, you know, have some sort of regulations related to that. They're going to make some adjustments. What they are and how they're defined is really going to come down to that player advisory council. It's going to come to that, you know, that council of players and them making that decision for the tour and what's in the best interest, mostly for the members, not you know, considering players that are Monday qualifying and things like that. They really have to at this point take care of their members, and doesn't matter what, there is always a pecking order for the tour. So if you just happen to be a player that's further down in priority ranking, unfortunately, you know, that's your place where you're at, and you're just going to have to fight out of the basement.
I guess we'll see when and if the tour restarts this year. I think that's a big thing, though. We keep talking about, you know, they have Colonial as the first event, which I believe is sometime in May, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, mid-May.
Mid-May. You know, what do you think is your best case scenario? Because I have my best case scenario for professional sports across the board, and neither one of us are experts in the health field, and, you know, who really gives a, you know, who really gives a, you know, about what we think of, sure, whether they, you know, when this starts up. But in your head, what's the best case scenario for you?
Is it this really May hard to start? Say. Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it keeps changing in my mind over and over again. And like we said, it really depends on medical officials more than anything. If we look at Toronto, for an example, which, you know, has banned these public events run by the city, they say it's not going to apply to sporting events, but sporting events are still under the mass gatherings ban by the province of Ontario, which is the province that we're in, which, you know, dictates there are only five people. So just because all of a sudden it looks like, hey, maybe we can have these events. I mean, five people, you can't really have many sporting events that are going to have a gathering of less than five people. So it's really hard to say, and I'd really hesitate to speculate.
That's fair. I think 2 weeks ago I had a, you know, I would have said we're full status come May, like everything's back to normal come May. And then as weeks go on, we're learning more and more, where I'm very skeptical that we see professional sports being played midsummer. I'm really concerned that it might be October before we see, you know, crowds of 20,000 people. And golf is a weird one with that. And a question that came to me recently was, say they do open up sports, but, you know, they aren't played in front of people. You know, hockey, how weird would that be? You see a whole hockey rink with no one in it. It'd be like a beer league game. Where I think golf, a lot of people, what they see on TV from the PGA Tour, the LPGA Tour, is, you know, the people that go to these events want to see. You know, I've been in, you know, pairings out on the PGA Tour carrying a bag where you actually do not see people for five, six, seven holes, right? There's one guy standing there with his arms in the air to the bushes that, you know, telling them to be quiet. So for me, I'm not worried about it in that sense. The sponsorship thing, you know, worries me in a lot of ways, but that's above my paycheck. But I'm not too worried about golf. If they did open up golf for TV purposes, I don't think it changes the experience at all on TV. And for a lot of players on the PGA Tour, it's almost just status quo.
Yeah, a lot of the money is obviously driven by the TV deals for the PGA Tour. So viewing wouldn't be hard, and you wouldn't notice that much different if you were a viewer watching. The logistics behind it would be the big issue. We're not talking about the 144 players. We're talking about, you know, who takes care of everything else that goes in there. And although there are not spectators there, there's still a lot of other people that are involved in each of the events, even if they don't have – concessions and a lot of other things that are there. That's where the big fear is, and how you're going to, you know, get a golf course ready for a PGA Tour as far as the level of the players. And in talking to you know, a golf course designer last night who had knowledge of talking to a course specifically about, you know, what their protocols they're going through right now, I mean, it's really particular. I mean, staff that are, you know, handling one piece of equipment, they're not allowed to be on other pieces of equipment. They don't, you know, they don't interact with the other staff members. They have one job. They basically are live close enough to the golf course that they're not even expecting them to use the bathroom facilities there. They're basically telling them go home and then come back. Really, in the end, the mechanic is the only person at this one facility that, you know, is really highly at risk. They're the one putting out the equipment in the morning, taking the equipment back in, you know, sanitizing and obviously in between. But, you know, just to do that, it's hard enough as it is to take care of a golf course, let alone to have a lot of other restriction on how you're doing it. So that would be the backside of it. And then you got to remember, if it's televised, you've got to have a TV crew there. You've got to have producers. There's certain things that you can do.
Talking 500 people.
Yeah, you're certainly, you know, you're in a lot of cases, there's some things that you can do remotely for, with their feeds and their broadcasts, but there's still a lot of people from a camera standpoint and so forth, sound otherwise, that would have to be there. So there's a lot of things to think out, and it's not as simple as people might think when they're just commenting on social media about it.
Exactly. And based on everything you just said, that's exactly why I do not see this happening come May. I think for me, best case scenario for the PGA Tour is probably June. I think they do have a unique standpoint that they could be the first professional sport back is golf. And I think every PGA Tour, every sports professional league, the commissioners of each they want to be that first one back. As disgusting as that does sound, the first one back is going to get insane numbers of audience because people are just itching to watch professional sports again.
Yeah, I mean, do you think you could see, 24 NBA players in an arena with one still camera, and that's, you know, that's what we end up with? I mean, you know, who knows what the possibility is going to be when things return, so.
No worries. Yeah, no, I agree with you 100% as you're getting a little phone call there. You know, this happens on the podcast.
our buddy Rob Miller trying to get a hold of me.
Oh, that's a problem. Glad you ignored that one. One other big note, and then we're going to hop into the golf tournament we watched this week, because we did watch another one. We watched the 1975 Masters this week, which was exciting for me. We're going to break that down in a moment. But the last big thing to note of cancellations, the Summer Olympics obviously canceled. Players hadn't necessarily qualified yet. Last week, you know, they were speculating, you know, the Canadian players have pulled out and everything along those lines, and we're speculating what's next. This is obviously the big news coming down after that, and I think the right decision considering the amount of people that if a golf tournament takes 500 people, the Olympics is a whole other ballgame.
Yeah, and the fact that we've got a set date for it now, you know, July 23rd, August 8th, 2021. So people know now when that's going to be. That's a target for a year from now. And really, when we talk about sports, they basically said that anybody within the rankings that are already qualified would qualify, but barely any sports had qualified their athletes yet. And that goes the same for golf as well. So, you know, they've got another year to work on getting the Olympics, and we'll see who ends up representing Canada and who represents everyone else.
Yeah. Do you think DJ plays now that there's not really a scheduling error?
I still don't think he plays. I don't think he really has that much interest. I mean, it seems he can always find an excuse, and it still might come down to scheduling. Who knows what's going to happen next year? But, you know, if I had to bet on it right now, I'd probably say DJ is not going to be an Olympian.
Fair enough. All right. Well, let's break down the golf tournament that you can watch. We noted this on the last podcast. You can watch every final round from any of the Masters dating all the way back to the 60s. So we went back to the 70s, the decade of the birth of Scotty, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, 1970. Yep.
1970.
So 5-year-old Scotty, when he fell in love, was when Jack Nicklaus picked up his fifth Masters green jacket. This was really cool for me. Obviously, I've never watched this. I've never gone back to watch it. And last night sat down and watched the 2 hours on YouTube, and I enjoyed it. It was a fun watch. It was unfortunate that I knew the outcome, and I'm hoping to watch one at some point where I just forget who won in general. But this was one, obviously I knew the outcome, and I'm glad I sat down through it. That's for sure.
Yeah, I didn't see this live. I wasn't a golfer at that point. But I will say that, you know, going back and watching it and seeing particular players was interesting. Seeing things from a technical standpoint as far as, you know, the TV broadcast, seeing things from a course condition standpoint, just looking at the variety of people that were there. And all, in my mind, all I was thinking was, you know, what's Stefan thinking when he sees this? He's probably just losing his mind going, wow, I mean, you know, how far has broadcasting come for sports and especially golf?
Yeah, the broadcasting part was huge for sure. Just, you know, kind of maybe one camera a hole, not really the cameras following each guy. It was really cool. One thing I do wonder, has anyone ever seen Hale Irwin and Elton John in the same room together?
Probably not.
I'm pretty sure they're the same person. That was interesting to me. And then the other thing that really popped out is the style back then was amazing. Like, I didn't see one outfit other than maybe the, like, the pants and the flare at the bottom of the pants. Like, it was very similar to what you would see people wearing these days, just very flashy colors, everything matching really well. No awful white belts, which I appreciated. No one really wore hats either. Everyone had the kind of the Beatles haircut going on. From what I noticed there. But yeah. That was the first thing that really popped out to me was the style.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking, you know, 45 years ago now, and you know, you saw a lot of polyester, a lot of crazy colors. A lot of people, as they do now, would wear green, some shade of green to, you know, they're going to the Masters. And, you know, I think there was every shade of green there, whether it be the announcers wearing some of their coats that they were to the spectators as well. And like you said, I mean, there was probably a lot of people, if they went back and watched it, and, you know, you said it, you know, for yourself at your age, you go back and watch this and they're probably going, oh, there's some pretty cool stuff that's there that, you know, from a vintage standpoint, they'd be interested in wearing. Whereas maybe, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, they probably said, no way, there's I'm not going to touch something from the 1975.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I there was so many outfits I would throw on right now. I mean, they were pretty flashy. Like, if you're wearing a lot of those, you better be playing at the Masters or shooting ball, that's for sure. Another thing to really note that I noticed, there's so much spin on the golf ball nowadays. You see guys at Augusta National, they hit it there, it just, you know, maybe a little bit of spin, some backspin with wedges, everything was spinning. That stood out to me right away. I was just in complete awe, the difference of the amount, the way the ball was moving, even though it was really hard to follow where the ball was moving. You really relied on the spectators a lot through that process, but the golf ball was just flying, landing on the green, spinning back 10 feet every single time. It was crazy.
Yeah, I would say, you know, if we look at conditioning wise, surfaces would have been a lot softer then. The grass would have been a lot longer. So, you know, you can see that in the putts, you know, whether it's a green like nine, where we're used to getting players above the green on nine at Augusta National, and they can barely breathe on the ball. But, you know, there you saw players actually could, you know, take a run at it. So that really impacted how it played. And you could see it even the styles of shots that they could play, you know, whereas nowadays they'd have to lob it super, super high. They could play lower shots and they would still stop, just because, again, you know, there's a little bit longer grass and it's a little bit softer. And you know, it's just a different time for conditioning. Even if you looked at the bunkers, you could see they weren't as well manicured. They didn't have the really tight edging to them. And I was looking even in the background, I could see, you know, lots of pine cones on the ground and things like that. Things that, you know, if you go to Augusta National now, you know, everything's picked up, everything's tight, everything's clean. And, you know, it's just gotten more and more like that over the years.
It is crazy. I also want the thing that I noticed was, you know, not the usual pins we're used to seeing. I just assumed the same Sunday pins had been around forever. And the one that, where I first noticed it was 16, yep. 16, the par three, usually right down middle of the green, but down on the left side, down closer by the bunker, closer to the water, very, you know, an attackable pin, a place where you can, you know, see aces happen on Sundays, and they do happen a lot on Sundays. So that it was up at the top, which is a much harder pin, not as exciting for the final stretch of the Masters, but it popped. That was the first thing I noticed. I was you know, hanging out, doing some other things while watching. And then when I picked up that, I was watching every hole, being like, I've never seen a lot of these pin placements.
Yeah, I saw ones like 11 was, you know, it's traditionally sort of down to the right, front right or front left. And this one was at the back left. And
which is a like way better pin for Sunday, in my opinion. That's a great pin.
Well, 16, though, is one that, you know, is definitely not as exciting. And I mean, in the end, it cost Tom Weisskopf because he ended up, you know, short of that green, chipped up, and then, you know, couldn't hold the ball up near the hole, and then two putted and made a bogey there, which, you know, ended up hurting him and his chance of winning the Masters. And I think you're right on 16. If they put it in the back there, just not as exciting. We would have not seen the shot like, you know, Tiger with his big chip in, the number of, you know, hole in ones that we've seen over the last, you know, just even the last 10 years or so. I don't know what the changes or what prompted them, but certainly probably just trying to keep things a little bit more exciting more than anything.
Yeah, speaking of hole in ones, Arnie's almost on 12, where he just almost dunks it. It looked like it spun out of the cup. that was cool for me as well, watching Arnie play a little bit, considering, you know, for me, the only Arnie I really know is the old man Arnie, right? Like, you know, from the Bay Hill days of hitting that driver into 18, that's the golf I know. And, you know, him hitting the ceremonial tee shots at the Masters. So it was cool to see these guys in their prime playing, just, and you know, not the slow swings. These guys were hammering at golf balls. It was a really cool experience. I highly recommend people go back and watch one from the 70s and maybe watch one from each decade and watch how it improves. And
were there particular players that you know, you mentioned Arnie, but were there any particular players that maybe you didn't know about that all of a sudden this weird name popped up there and they were in the mix? Johnny Miller obviously tied for second. You're pretty familiar with Johnny Miller, but were there any other ones? I mean, you probably hadn't seen Tom White Weisskopf play much.
No, obviously I haven't been following Weisskopf going back and watching all his final rounds. I actually thought, I was like, wait, Jack Nicklaus has a son in here? Like, wait a minute, how old is he? But I think it was Brent Nichols or something like that that. I was like, what's going on here? Like, there was just names like that, which are, you know, back to those days would have just been, you know, your average Joes out there that you would probably have seen at a lot of these tournaments, but obviously didn't go on to win 18 majors. So no, it was cool. No one else really popped up to me. You know, Johnny Miller was there, which, you know, I'm not a Johnny Miller fan at all. So
and he gagged it. That 11th pin cost him. I mean, I don't know if you caught that one. He missed a really short putt on 11, and you know, he had a fantastic weekend that year. He shot 11 under on the weekend. Ended up tying for second with Weisskopf, and it was funny when they were sitting there afterwards, and Weisskopf had, you know, at that point it was his fourth time finishing second, and you know, would never go on to win it, yet he was talking about it, and he said, you know, I know one thing and I believe it, I will win this tournament someday. And guess what, he never did, and you know, became a great designer, you know, he looked like, after, you know, finishing second for the fourth time in 6 years, that this guy was destined to win a bunch, but never did. And obviously Miller didn't as well.
No, I'm glad he didn't, because he would have talked about it every single time on the broadcast. Really cool though, experience. And it's crazy that Jack, you know, he looked so good the whole term. It's crazy. At that point, you would have thought this guy's going to win. He just won in 72. He's won in 75. You got to think he's going to win three more times. He goes on that 11-year hiatus with the at Augusta, picks up the one in 86. So it was exciting. Highly recommend people go back and watch. Maybe not this one since we broke down, but go find one you haven't, you don't know the outcome off the top of your head, and watch it, because it's definitely worth it. And I wonder if our guest this week has been doing that, going back and watching these old Masters tournaments. Who do we have this week, Scotty?
Doug Laurie's going to join us. Doug was the 2012 PGA of Canada Junior Leader of the Year. Good friend, well-known within the coaching circles for working with juniors, a very dynamic personality, certainly somebody that you'll want to follow on social media. And, you know, he's joining us to really talk not only about junior golf, but also to talk to us about some things that we can do inside to work on our games, for most of us being self-isolated right now. So Doug Laurie is our guest. All right, we want to welcome to the podcast Doug Laurie, good friend, 2012 PGA of Canada Junior Leader of the Year, U.S. Kids Master Coach, a guy that, you know, I've gotten to know quite well. I love his work ethic. I love the way he works with juniors, relates to them in a way nobody else really does. And he'll get into that a little bit in his interview. Welcome to the show.
I can't tell you how honored I am, guys. Thank you so very much for having me on this. It's a joy. And you know what, Scotty? I right back at you, man. I've really enjoyed becoming a lot closer in friendship with you. And yeah, junior golf is my lifeblood, and I can't wait to throw up all over everybody here tonight.
Well, I know I'm a big, you're a big fan of mine as well. So you did that. Thanks, Steph. Was going to go unsaid. So thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah,
I appreciate that. You got great haircut too.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, Doug, I know, from talking to you, and we talk about it a fair bit, you know, just besides golf as well, but, you know, huge basketball guy. And that was really your background. That was sort of your entry into sports. But, mm-hmm. you know, how did that shape you not only as an athlete, but starting to think about coaching and everything else?
That's a great question. Basketball was a very sport when I was 12. I was some, my parents were like, I wasn't a hockey guy. My parents weren't hockey people. So they enrolled me in basketball, and it was like, all of a sudden it was just like, okay, go. And I would be out like in March in snow shooting baskets. And it was just, I found it was just something that I just gravitated to, and it really helped my brain space because my brain was very active, and it just gave me the speed of my brain. Like it matched my brain speed to work. And I was very fortunate. I went to high school at one of the best high school programs in the province at Runnymede. We won two provincial titles when I was there. Went on to spent a year at Acadia, lost in the national championship there, played for Dave Nutbrown, came back, went to Humber College and spent 3 years at Humber College. And in my last year in 91, was co-captain of Humber College's very first national championship team. And the really cool part was that those 3 years were very formidable for me in more ways than one, because the man that coached me, my high school coach was a legend, John Petrchak. I got to give him a shout out. He was absolutely an icon. He still is an icon at 82 or 81. He's just an amazing man. He really helped me a lot through my high school years. But the man who coached me in college, Mike Cates, he coached the national team with Jay Triano. He is by far one of the best basketball brains I've ever met in my life. He's worked with Steve Nash. He's also an unbelievable golfer. He's a golf historian. He can tell you lineage of golf instructors and who they were mentored by all the way back from like Toski and like, like all these guys from back in the day. And like we're at Cherry Hill and he says to me, hey, do you know who won the 1972 Canadian Open here at Cherry Hill? I was like, no, he rhymes off who it was. I still couldn't remember who it is. But he got to watch George Knudsen up close and personal because he's a member at Oakdale. And so Mike shaped me in my coaching side, and I didn't even realize he was doing this through basketball. He was an amazing coach from the standpoint that he could build a relationship with you. He could motivate the crap out of you. And he could also make you feel like you weren't done and you had to go out and just leave it all out on the floor. And I gravitate to a story I wrote about in a blog post where we were playing Sheridan and our arch rivals. We were up two. I got fouled going to the line with 4 seconds left. And I go to the line, and normally it's the opposing coach that calls timeout to freeze you. Well, our coach called timeout to freeze you. I'm like, well, what are you doing?
He's freezing his own player.
Right. And so we sit down, and he doesn't even look at me. He's addressing all the other guys, and he says, when he makes these free throws, don't touch anybody. We're up 4. They can't beat us. Just leave them alone. He used a few expletives at that time. But at the same time, he just looked at me and says, when he makes those free throws, it's not if, or if he doesn't. He didn't even lend any negativity to the moment. So went back out, made both. They came down. They actually hit a 3 right at the buzzer, but we won by 1. And that was the year we went on to win the national title. So, I mean, he taught me more afterwards than when we started playing golf and walking together. And we've played so much golf together that, you know, it's an amazing point to listen, because he was a school teacher and he would help me understand how to communicate with people. And This is the really cool part, because it really, I didn't realize I was going to be a golf coach until 2010 full time. And once I did that and I realized that I was going to be, juniors were my thing. It's, I haven't looked back. And the really neat part about this whole thing is Mike's mentorship on this has allowed me to really realize why I'm so good with kids. And for that, it's because I build relationships with them. I build this rapport, and they instantly become a bond with myself, where it's like, there's trust, there's buy-in. And I honestly and truly, they know that I care about them. And it doesn't matter if they're four or they're 14, it's a blanket. And there's an art to that, but we can get into that a little bit later.
I mean, I know your story, Doug. And I mean, obviously I know that, you know, the impact on Humber, because, you know, I've been in that locker room. I was in your locker room at Humber when I was at Loyalist. We used to use that basketball locker room when we were in volleyball, we were a visiting team. And so I know it, you know, there was a lot of structure that was there. And, you know, as you said, though, it translates from every sport. It wasn't about basketball. It was about a lot more than that. And how do you put those components into your coaching as well, specifically?
You know, it goes without saying that the structure you need to have, I think one of the things that I really truly believe that a lot of golf coaches need to do is understand their audience and be able to understand to relate to the audience. If you have a 7-year-old, what's relevant to a 7-year-old versus a 12-year-old? What's relevant to a 15-year-old versus a 4-year-old? And are you able to run the gambit and know what's going on and how you can relate to them so that you're A, communicating, B, getting your message across, C, they're having a lot of fun, and B, they're learning. Because you're standing out there and you're being, you know, you're hired to inspire these kids to turn them on to this game of golf. You know, like they're, you don't know why they're there. They may have been made to be there. They may have just been suggested, but it's super important that you take this golf pro hat and you set it aside and you realize that you're there for the child because it's all about them. And truly the being coached in basketball and how that shaped me is because whenever we stepped on the court, it was about us. It wasn't about the coach and it wasn't about the wins. It was about the players. And it's about how can we be our very best at every single moment we stepped on the court. And I honestly and truly know that that's been a synergy for me because you know what? If kids don't want to participate, that's okay. I'm not going to make somebody try and do something if they don't want to be there. And I think that's so super important. I was talking with a friend of mine the other day and we were talking about how, you know, our jobs are, we are giants compared to these kids. And it's super important that you get down to their level and you make them feel comfortable and safe. And also you recognize them because, hey, Coach Doug, he said hi to me the other day. He gave me a fist pump. It's absolutely without a doubt makes their day. So there's such a strategy. And I really think sometimes we think it's supposed to be X's and O's for this golf thing when we really need to put those X's and O's aside because we can always get to those things and we make it more about the kids and more about how they're going to be, you know, feel safe and enjoy themselves. That will engage these children to want to play the sport for the rest of their lives.
Clearly basketball's had a huge impact in the way you're coaching. And as you talked about getting down to their level, mm-hmm. thinking back to, you know, the basketball days, you know, the coach gets you all sit on the bench. They don't stand above you. They crouch down and get to your level. Eye contact is key and you don't want them looking up at you. That there's no intimidation, does nothing in coaching. I agree 100%. But going into this, as I said, basketball, huge impact. As we sit here right now, you're wearing, you know, Raptors hat, Raptors shirt, you know, through yep. and through. Clearly a big Raptors fan. And I think everyone can relate to the run they went on last year to win their first NBA championship. Mm-hmm. Who on that team last year would you want your players to emulate it the most? Is there certain qualities that you look for in a golf in a basketball player that you feel can relay into the golf, the game of golf as well?
Well, I think that's an absolutely phenomenal question, Steph. I mean, absolutely phenomenal question. Leadership, you know, you look at Kyle Lowry, but he had to give up a little bit last year to DeMar just because DeMar was the dominant entity. But I'll tell you the person that I think was a shining light that just got the job done. And it wasn't about fanfare. He went out and did his work and just got it was Fred VanVleet. Absolutely bar none. The worst, probably had one of the worst first 12 games of the playoffs. I don't know, his nerves. Has his son, and all of a sudden it's like the lid is blown off, and for the last 15 games or so, his name is like being tossed around as an MVP, and why? Fred is 5'11", not tremendously fast, not great athletically, but man, can shoot the ball. He's fast with the ball, and he can get to the hoop and make the ball get in the hoop. Sometimes better than I've ever seen a 5'11 guy do that amongst the trees. So, you know, you look at the work ethic. And the one thing I was talking to my very close friend, Mike Grange from Sportsnet, and he was telling me that one thing that sets Fred aside from a lot of these guys, and this is what I would love to see in most of my juniors, is he doesn't sweat it. How many kids do you know don't sweat it? They know that they're capable in their ability, but they don't sweat it. It's a very few and far between that are, it's not cockiness, but the confident in the fact that they know where they are in the world of golf and how they can then just go out, get the job done and feel confident in what they do. I think it takes a very special individual to do that. And, you know, I've got a couple of kids that I think kind of fit that. One girl in particular, her name's Alexa Ouellette. She won the Golf Ontario Bantam this year. I mean, I call her Chicken Hawk as to from Foghorn Leghorns, Mary Melody's Chicken Hawk. Never backed down from anybody. That little, you know, Henry the Chicken Hawk. He never backed down to try and get the chickens. And she's very much like that. She doesn't back down. She's a little tiny thing. She's 12. She's 13 now. But again, she's playing girls who are hitting at 30, 40 past her, and she doesn't ever stop. Right. So I really think that work ethic, Fred VanVleet, 100%.
I love that answer. I will help you out there. You did mean Kawhi Leonard as who Kyle Lowry had to give up. You said DeRozan, but, you know, us Raptors fans.
Did I say DeRozan? DeRozan. I meant Kawhi. Sorry.
Yeah, it's okay. DeRozan, he was there forever. It's all good, you know. If you said Jose Calderon, I would have let it pass too. Right? You know.
Jose Calderon, yeah. Exactly. Great.
I do like that. Now, how? Give us a little bit of a how, because I think it's easy to say don't sweat the small stuff to any golfer, and usually by hole three, you've sweat through all three layers of clothes you're wearing because you're sweating 100%. every missed putt you've made, or you know that one that went OB. So, like, is there a motto that you give your players, or something to repeat, or anything that helps them with an actual how? Because it's easy to say do this, but the how is the key.
That's extremely difficult. I'm going to tell you, I'm going to be straight up and honest with you. It, you know, I've been on both ends of the spectrum with someone who's won a world championship. You know, at the age of 11, Vanessa Borovilos goes out and torches the field in the first round of the world championships and shoots 68. The next day she goes out, she makes a birdie and a bogey. She's even par, makes another bogey on the front nine and loses her mind for two holes. Like, the waterworks is just not stop. It's trying to calm her down, trying to not, you know, get her off the ledge. She thinks she's like going into a tailspin. And meanwhile, she goes out on the back nine and shoots, you know, one under for the day and makes 5-6 footers or just around 5-6 footers for par on the back nine and breaks the spirit of the girl that was chasing her down. Goes out the last day and turns in one under par and then birdies 10, 11, 13, 14, misses from 8 feet on 16, misses from, or sorry, 8 feet on 15, 8 feet on 16 and 6 feet from 17. Like, she could have been 64, but the fact is the confidence comes from when you've put in the work and you have a little bit more maturity. It comes from understanding the fact that it's a marathon, not a sprint. Everybody wants it now. Our 21st century athlete is in such a time, I'm stealing this from Brett McCabe, is in a time where, oh my gosh, they want it now. And if they don't get it now, they have to get on the phone and call one or two or three or four or five people to find out who's going to tell them what they want to hear. So they can then go back out and say, oh yeah, he was right. And the thing is as their coach, it's so super hard to keep them grounded and focused. And it's just all about the process and trusting the fact that we have them working on a marathon, not a sprint. It's reps, it's conditioning. It's all about getting to the final and getting to the point of where they want to go. Is that collegiate golf? Great. Is that professional golf? Amazing. But it's having a proper understanding of that, that a lot of these kids think they need it right now. If they're not winning, oh my gosh, something's wrong. Why? Do they always have to win? No. But what if your scoring average is getting better every single year because you keep getting better? A lot of people don't look at the right things. And I think it's really important as a coach that you have to understand who it is in front of you and how you've mapped out their roadmap to be able to get them to their desired goal. And again, I'll state this, stealing this from James Clear. Goals are great, but you don't rise to the level of your goal. You fall to the level of your system. So if you don't have a system in place, you don't ever achieve those goals. The goals are the end result.
I like that. I do want to go further a bit on this because we're talking about, you know, sweating the small stuff, and you relate it back to confidence, and confidence coming from a place of work. I've had the ability to walk inside the ropes with, you know, the best of the best on the PGA Tour. And obviously their confidence is as high as ever. You got PGA Tour winners there, you know, and they're still sweating the small stuff, right? And driving themselves insane. What do you do when it's like, okay, you've reached the pinnacle at this point, right? This is the top of the goal, the furthest your dreams went, and you're still the mental game is still taking over at some point.
I think it's really important to understand where that's happening. If it's somebody who's entering into puberty, you could totally understand because their brain space and their endorphins, their chemical makeup in their head starts changing. Scott, you and I both being fathers and daughters, we can appreciate that. But in all honesty, you know, if they've achieved something at the age of 11, how do you keep them, you know, reaching for the prize? Because remember, it's often you have to get grounded and help the parents understand that, look, what your child achieves at 11 isn't necessarily what they're going to achieve at 12 or 13 or 14. But like, because as they grow, as they get bigger, as they get stronger, things start going differently. When you're 11, if you miss it, you're not missing it 20 yards into the woods, right? Because you don't hit it that fast. You're not swinging that fast. At 70 miles an hour, you're not hitting a driver offline that much if you're an elite player at the age of 11. But when you get to be 14 and you're swinging it at 95 miles an hour and you're 2 degrees open, well, now you're going to start missing fairways and hitting it crooked. But what happens is people lose that focus. They look at the results rather than the person and working on the development of understanding how they're going to get through the hardest part of their development, their growth, their peak height velocity, how they grow, and helping them understand that the mental side of things is all part of that game. So you have to think about strategies. You have to think about how do you coach them? How do you lead them into reading some material, maybe listening to some material, maybe taking a course on mindfulness. I pulled in a great mindfulness coach friend of mine, Greg Klim, who came in and talked about how to find mindfulness on a golf course. And it was really interesting because some got it, some didn't. And that was probably because they were too young at the time. But I'd love to have him come back in and do it again, because I really think that this is where that could make such a big difference in everybody else's game. So there's a myriad of things. And I think a really good coach will have that all mapped out and give those kids opportunities to do that.
Yeah. When we think about that though, and, you know, Stefan's talking a little bit about, you know, PGA Tour, you know, do you think in applying that to that level of player, do you think maybe they don't have that coaching that gives them that support, or maybe they're in a situation where, you know, they've won, they've had success, they've got themselves to that high of a level that all of a sudden they're going, you know what? I should be doing this. I should be having these expectations.
Well, I think Jordan Spieth's a great example of that right now.
Okay.
Well, look at what Jordan Spieth achieved prior to the last 2 years.
Sure.
I will point out an interesting observation I made 2 years ago. I was down at coach camp, Andrew Rice's coach camp, and Cameron McCormick was standing there talking about, presenting about Jordan's stats. And they basically said if he can get 5 miles an hour faster on his driver, he would have won two more tournaments and maybe a major that year. And I was like, wow. And I think this was right after he won the British. And I sit there and I was thinking, that's very interesting. And when you look at some of these swing changes that he's made over the last couple of years, and you sit there and you wonder, okay, so why are you trying to hit it farther when your stats are this good in this area? Because it seems like all of a sudden something's changed. You don't think that he would have, and he's only 26 years old. And you look at him and you see how he gets frustrated on the greens and misses shots. And he's missing greens and he's getting more and more frustrated. He's like 85th in the world or 78th in the world right now. And why does that happen? How does somebody who go from the pinnacle, top five in the world, to where he is now, and in a very short period of time, is he lacking confidence? Somewhere he is. Because you can't sit there and think that a 26-year-old guy with all this talent is hitting it that much bad, that much poorly? Is it the coaching? I don't think so. So why and what is changing and how does that have to change for somebody of that magnitude? Now let's just bring it back down a bit. Think about a 12-year-old, 11-year-old, or 14-year-old who's had success and now is trying to clamber up and they're wondering why they aren't winning everything in their backyard when they go into the other tournaments and they're playing against tougher competition. Because what happens is the playing field gets more even and these outliers start showing up. Right? An outlier at the age of 11 isn't necessarily going to be the outlier at the age of 12, age of 17. So it's trying to get them to understand how to play through this. And often it's that confidence of realizing that they need to just keep working on the process. And it's hard sometimes because you don't believe it because you're not seeing the results. Everybody gets so result oriented rather than on understanding that sometimes you go up and down, ebb and flow, like a chart.
Yeah, I think
I agree.
I think there's two things here, too. You know, one, you know, I'm going to take it on where I'm just going to get my opinion really quick. The fact of saying Jordan Spieth gaining 5 miles per hour means 2-3 more wins is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard at this point. I'm not going to lie. Because
we can always rely on Stephen to give
I wish I could take you back, Steph, to that because Cameron Corbett stand there and said that based on his stats.
Yeah, that's my thoughts. Cameron, if you want to come chat about it, I'll give you that because I don't think it's true. Second thought is why are we changing something that's broken, right? Like are we now right. at this point we're getting greedy in a lot of ways. And I don't think that's unfair to say is like, yes, we are trying to improve, but you just won the British Open. You won three majors in what, 3 years or something along those lines, mm-hmm. right? You're one of the, if not the best player in the world for a long stretch of time. I don't think you need that extra 5%, like do what you do best. And you know, if you look at it from a music standpoint, right, think about it in the way of like everyone has that first great album and then it's the mm-hmm. second album that they try to do something different or they try to expand themselves, and the second album is the key success to all musicians' careers. And the best people that do it is they don't go too far. It's small steps. And I feel like in Jordan's case, based on what I'm hearing, is that he tried to go from Jordan Spieth's first album to the Dustin Johnson second album when you aren't 100%. Dustin Johnson.
Yeah. 100%.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, especially you see a lot of players that get their way to the PGA Tour. I mean, I know from, you know, having a good friend that got there for a couple of years that once he got there, he felt like he had to change his whole game just because it was the PGA Tour. But, you know, he had done so much to get there and had so much success that, you know, he really destroyed what he had taken there in the first place. So,
Fritchie?
No, that's more McQuillan. But,
oh, Matt. Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
So,
yeah.
I mean, but it's a case of, yeah, it's not a case of not trying to get better. I mean, you're still trying to get better, but you don't necessarily have to, you know, throw at everything to achieve that. You can do it in incremental ways.
The one thing to note too is for their whole career as a golfer, this is the weirdest thing, right? Every other sport doesn't have this. So for their whole career as the golfer, it's the PGA Tour is the main thing they want, right? And then once they get to the PGA Tour, each week comes and goes. And when we're in these finite games, really, right? Where if you look at something like basketball, for example, the mm-hmm. first goal is let's get to the NBA. Let's say that's the first main goal. Now you get to the NBA, you have something to play for that means the most thing, and that's that NBA championship, right? Where in golf, you get to the PGA Tour, and now you change it where every single shot, and no other sport has this, every single shot you take costs you money. And now we're talking a whole other mindset, a whole other way you're trying to coach people in the mindfulness side of things. So I'm going to bring this back to you, Doug. If that's the case, and you're a coach of somebody that literally every single shot is a ton of money, are we actually screwing something up by trying to change that approach rather than just changing the approach of setting these actual goals in mind rather than just this money goal, I guess?
Oh, that's a really hard one when you're doing it for your living, right? It's so hard to look at that and go, how do you divide the line? You know, I often think that those who are on the PGA Tour are there for a reason, because they are absolutely been successful as younger golfers, right? They've worked their tails off, and they were successful when they were in college and mini tours and successful. You have the outlier stories of the guys that have journeymen and worked real hard, the Mike Liggs of the world and stuff. And, you know, but Mike has always been pretty good. And you look at this and you think, okay, so how is it that these guys are, you know, sure, they realize that, you know, they're bleeding money every time they hit a shot. But I think when they realize that, hey, I'm making every cut, because day in, day out, I'm following this routine and this system that I've got down. And this system allows me to compete on a daily basis at the highest level. And I'm making money every single time. I think when they think that they should be winning or should be in the top 10 every single time, and they put too much onus on every shot, that's where they run into problems. I think the best of the best don't think about these shots every single time. I think they're able to compartmentalize it, and they're able to set it aside. They look at it as their job. They look at it as, let's go to work. They look at it as, like, how many greens can I hit? What's the game that they're playing on every single shot, and how close they can get it to what they want in their headspace? And that's what separates them from all these other guys that are thinking they're bleeding money every single time they hit a ball not where they want it.
So do you think then if the NBA – the players, all of a sudden there was a cut at halftime and the players were all of a sudden with their mindset change? I mean, you know, you put it in that terms, we're talking about golf. These guys are trying to make the cut every week, and they put so much onus on, you know, these first two rounds. I mean, what would the NBA look like if all of a sudden you perform
the
well
difference in that
and you were gone? Yeah.
Well, the difference in that is that it's a golf ball and the golfer on the PGA Tour. In the NBA, it's you with three or four other guys.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, as much as you're running plays and you're passing the ball, you're playing against other guys your size, if not bigger, that are trying not to let you achieve what you need to do. Yes, the golf course is the other team in this aspect, but at the same time, it's you and this ball and your clubs performing this complex ritual to try and make the ball go where we want with a little tiny shovel. I honestly truly think that it's if there was a cut, you'd see a difference in how the game was played.
Game would not be the same. I don't think you don't need a 3-point line.
I think we'd have an all-star game is what we'd have, because you either have a dunk or a 3-pointer, right? Yeah. I mean, it would be kind of like that open concept. And because guys would want to try and make as much as they could, guys would be chucking up all over the place. Mm-hmm. But then again, how do you make the cut, right? In golf, mm-hmm. it's up to you, because it's you and this ball. And if you're not being affected by outside agencies like, Victor Hovland's not tackling Colin Murakawa or boxing him out as he after he hits his wedge shot into the
that might be fun to see.
It's like a scene from you ever seen the movie Basketball where they try to combine the sports? Yeah. I think we could go down hypothetical lane for forever here and combining
yes,
sports 100%. And tackling. I do think we should wrap it up with everyone. Everyone's locked in their homes right now with COVID-19 going on. And
right.
I think the best thing to do is I'm sure there's many parents at home that are listening like, hey, what can I do with my kid with golf? A, they're driving me nuts. But B, I want them to be doing something inside. So from a junior coach perspective and just a coach perspective, what tips do you have right now for people to be working on indoors?
Well, it's great. You know, the magic of technology is that I've been doing Zoom lessons with most of my kids. And whether they're in their backyard, whether they're in their up at their chalet at Collingwood, taking divots out of the big, huge field, someone's in their basement rolling putts. I really think you have to be creative at this time. A aluminum ruler, is the best Canadian Tire, $8.99, really great for putting. Just put the ball in the hole and roll it down the ruler and see if you can get it to stop on a washcloth. That's like an easy and simple one. If you have a putting mat, you come up with different drills, getting it through cans of soup or something like that as a track. For golf swings, find a mirror. If you don't have a mirror, just work on trying to see if you can swing the club as slow as possible in as much of a regular golf swing manner as possible to get to a finish. Almost like you're in super slow-mo BizHub swing vision camera, and see if you can do that 10 times. It's a really hard drill to do. If you're able to hit golf balls, work up through your bag, you know, keep swinging, do some, you know, if you want to work on some speed, work on some speed sticks. But there's a variety of things that you can do. I think Amazon is really hot right now with golf nets and golf mats and selling them out. And it's really just about being creative. If you've got a coach, get a hold of them and do something online. I mean, you know, make that connection back with your coach so that your kid can see and have your coach inspire your child to work on their game. And I mean, I tried working on my chipping yesterday, but my dog seems to want to catch all my ping pong balls and won't give them back to me. So.
I like it. I like it. Scotty, one thing that I did notice, we're going to do an early mailbag here.
Yeah.
I had a couple mailbag questions for you. So Scott's going to open up the mailbag real quick.
All right.
For our guest this week.
All right. We had a couple of questions come in specifically for you. They're junior related. So you're the most qualified guy I know to answer them. How have basically first thing, at what age for a junior should a golfer consider private lessons versus group instruction?
I really think it has to do with the individual of the child. You know, group is so awesome up until about the age of 6 or 7. When the child feels like they need to do more, and if they ask to do more, and the parent is kind of thinking, okay, so I want them to get more individual instruction. You need to start doing your research and finding somebody who's very good with kids at that age. If you can't find anybody, keep them in the group stuff. And then, you know, as they get a little bit older, just try and find where the programs are. I can tell you right now that Golf Ontario is working on a junior pathway for parents to be able to find this roadmap, and I'm a part of that, and it's going to be really cool. It's coming down the pipeline, so that look for that. But yeah, it's really up to the child. I really, really, because I mean, I give individual lessons to a 4-year-old just because she's pretty awesome, but at the same time, she does amazing stuff when she goes into group lessons. So it's really a mixture. It depends on the child.
All right, that's fair enough. So one last one for you then. What's the biggest fitting mistake when it comes to choosing clubs for kids?
Just buying something because it's cheap. I am a U.S. Kids master coach, and I will tell you right now, U.S. Kids does one thing, junior golf. They make junior clubs. They don't make any other clubs. They make junior clubs. They are the lightest and the best for kids to develop their golf swing, bar none. All these other sets, off the rack, pro line, whatever it is, their weighted heads are too heavy, the shafts are too flippy, and you will not develop a child's golf swing that way. You need to get the right equipment in their hands. And U.S. Kids is by far and large, until the child gets to be swinging the golf club somewhere around 70 miles an hour, you keep them in U.S. Kids and you will not go wrong.
All right, that's awesome. One last question before we wrap this up. So we're going to bring it back to the Raptors. I want your all-time favorite player that the average fan wouldn't remember. So probably you're going to have to go back at least 3 years, I would assume, before, you know, these runs. So your all-time favorite player the average fan wouldn't remember. Then I'm going to give you mine as well.
All-time favorite player. Oh, boy. That's a great question. Oh, man. Okay. I'm going to have to say Antonio Davis.
Wow. Do we get a why on that one?
Yeah, I definitely need her a why on that one.
Why? He was an awesome man. He was 6'9", brought it every single day, strong, and a great rebounder. And I liked his whole demeanor. I liked the way he was. I mean, granted, you know what? Like, that's the name that comes to my head. Just right off the hop. I mean, other than the fact that I will give you a very cool story about Matt Bonner, the Red Rocket. Matt Bonner was from New Hampshire, and Matt Bonner, when he was in high school, would go to New Hampshire College and watch my very good friend, Wayne the Fridge Robertson, who played for New Hampshire College in Division II, led the nation in rebounding at 6'5", 290, and could take it over 6'10 guys. He was like a Charles Barkley clone. And he set the Division II, and they lost to Troy State in double overtime in the NCAA Final Four Division II in, I think it was 93 or 92. And I'll tell you right now, Matt Bonner would go and watch Wayne, and then Wayne actually knew who Matt Bonner was when he ended up playing for the Toronto Raptors. There's a kind of cool story.
It's really cool. I was going to ask you why they called you him the fridge, but when you're 6'5", 290, I think that sells itself.
He was only 240 when he 240, 250 was in high school and could fly. Like, he could jump, right?
Only.
And he goes down to college and he comes back, and his arms and shoulders, he gets on the weight program, are like my quads. Like, the man was massive.
He put on the freshman 50, not the freshman 15.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's impressive.
I'm going to give you mine real quick. I actually joked about this player earlier. Jose Calderon was my guy. I got a love affair for the point guards.
Jose, do you know? I tell you.
He was a cheap Steve Nash at the time, and that's the best we could have got. Scotty, you got your favorite Raptor?
You got a guy?
Oh.
You got a guy, Scotty?
No, I don't think so, because I wasn't always a Raptors guy. I mean, you know, I grew up like in Boston, and sorry. So, you know, I moved. Yeah, exactly. So
I'm a Larry Bird fan. Don't get me wrong. Nobody else, but Larry Bird.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, fine. Yeah. From French Lick, but.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
That's all
you
good.
Don't have anybody, eh? No,
not really.
Nice.
No.
You're going to say Vince Carter.
What a great way to end the interview. Doug, nice, thank you so much.
You asked.
That's fair. Doug, thanks so much for coming on. I'm glad we could talk some Raptors, talk some tips and junior golf. And, you know, you can clearly tell you got a passion for the game, but coaching is clearly your first and most important love. And we love what you're doing for all the juniors out there. So keep doing exactly what you're doing, Doug.
Guys, Steph, Scotty, thank you so very much for having me on, guys. It was a pleasure, more so than you ever think, and I thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Doug, for that interview. Thank you for some tips on what I can do inside my house right now. I need to go pick up some ping pong balls, though. I've been chipping in the basement with a regular golf ball. Oh. Wife hasn't noticed the dent in the drywall yet. Maybe caught one a little bit thin. So definitely going to pick up some ping pong balls at some point this week and practice some of those drills you guys have been talking about.
As long as your dog and cat are not around, those ping pong balls could disappear pretty quickly. Although you could incorporate them into your drills if you want. Maybe you can teach them to retrieve the balls for you.
Yeah, I do have a retriever. Hopefully that works. last week we talked on the podcast of an idea of a Ryder Cup. The Ryder Cup is happening this year. We're in a really weird standpoint where if we don't know when golf comes back, maybe the points, they don't exist. Maybe they just simply go by this idea of just picking a team, you know, 12 captains picks, that's it. And I kind of came up with the idea, if that was the case, and I don't actually believe it's going to be, but let's go with a maybe. If that was the case, what would those teams look like? So Scott and I decided we're going to do that. Scott's going to take on the Europe team as the team captain of Europe, 12 captains picks, and I'm going to take on the U.S. team. We're going to go one by one here of our players and why we decided to pick them, going over all 12. So pretty simple. I think everyone understands what we're doing. So let's get started, Scotty. Your team, you're up with your first pick. Who do you have?
I'm going to take Tommy Fleetwood, who was the number one in points before this all happened. And, you know, he's a guy I would take anyways. You know, he's obviously played very well on both sides of the ocean, around the world. Great ball striker. I think a lot of the other players as well like him. So he's somebody that you can pair him with someone easily. So I think just from that standpoint, and he's a guy that can hit a lot of greens, which I think is really important as well. So Fleetwood's number one for me.
Good wind player too. There's nothing I love more than watching Tommy Fleetwood hit three quarter shots. Just so swaggy.
And you want to watch that hair blowing in the wind too.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. That's a jealousy thing though. My first pick is obvious. I'm taking Tiger Woods with the first pick. It's Tiger Woods. I'm not going to go into anything more. He, you know, probably could have been the player of the year last year if picked up maybe one or two more wins, or one more win. I think he ends up being the player of the year last year. So Tiger Woods, pretty simple.
Yeah, and I think people will see that as we work our way down here. I mean, the first few picks are fairly obvious, but you know, we reach a little deeper as we work our way through.
Yeah, why don't you give your next two picks?
All right, we'll go John Rahm and Rory. So those are no-brainers for me as well, much like you're picking Tiger Woods. Certainly have been dominant in the last little while on a worldwide stage, you know, playing very well on the European Tour, but playing as very well on the U.S. side as well. You know, they've gotten some wins. They've proven they can win. They've got some experience. They're just anchors for your team. And your guys, they're guys you know are going to be able to get some points for you. So I think those two you've got to take.
I agree with that. My next pick is Phil Mickelson. Obviously not playing that great of late, but if you're doing a Ryder Cup where there are no points involved, Phil's going to show up. Phil, you know, he's going to have some side bets going while he's out there. This is what Phil loves to do. I think he stays engaged longer in these type of events just because it's more exciting. Every single hole has excitement. I think Phil just can, you know, forget where he is at times and make, you know, silly mistakes. So Phil's my next pick. And then I'm going to go Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka. I like the idea that these two guys potentially got in a fist fight after the last Ryder Cup, and that, you know, in the American room, I want guys that are like, you know, maybe the night before they just wrestle each other and they just get everyone fired up. And these two, you know, boys get in the gym and throw a bunch of weights around and be jocks and just get everyone loose. And you know, at least, you know, if something doesn't, if you're not playing well, at least you can rely on these two guys to provide you with some sort of entertainment in the room.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of why, you know, I almost favor this type of way of picking the team. I get it, you know, getting players qualified based on merit, but, you know, having the opportunity just to pick out your team and to pick out the characteristics of the players, sometimes it's intangibles. I mean, talking about Phil, for example, he might not be a guy who gets in on points now, but there's a lot of other characteristics that he brings there to the team room that could be very important as far as the dynamic of your team. All right, my next two, I'm going to take Tyrrell Hatton, who, you know, talking about guys that are emotional, can really provide a spark. You know, that can be good and bad. I mean, you could have somebody flame out and you know, be chucking clubs all over the place. But I think he's a guy that, you know, could light a fire under a teammate. I mean, if you pair him up with somebody, you know, he's going to light a fire under the other person. And on the other side of it as well, I mean, he's going to take it hard one way or the other in playing the event especially if he's going out as singles. I mean, he wants to win no matter what. And that's what you want out of your players. You want players that want to win.
I like that. Pair him up with somebody like John Rahm. Those two guys just getting right fired up out there. A fun match, DJ and Brooks versus John Rahm and Hatton. I'd watch that. My next two picks, I'm going with the young guys. Well, I guess they're not even young anymore. They're both almost 30, if not 30. I got Ricky Fowler and Justin Thomas. These guys.
What are you saying about yourself then? If you're not, you're saying they're not young anymore.
Yeah, I've moved on from that. Yep. Ricky and Justin are boys. I think they'd be good in the room. They've been on many Ryder Cups in the past. Ricky is, you know, with his putter, he could win any match out there. So got to go with it. And Justin's just all around great stud. I don't really need to go further in this. I think they're fun guys too. You know, I'm looking for a room that can be fun. Cause I'm going to get into some players later. Just, I'm sure you know where one of these are that maybe not the most fun to be around.
All right. I'll throw a couple more at you. Danny Willett, who's a guy who's rebounded, won a Masters and then sort of disappeared. But, you know, his game has come back to him. And the reason why I would take him more than anything else is that it's his putting that has sparked his return. And I mean, really, when you talk about playing matches, a putter is equal to anyone. And you need mm-hmm. somebody who can make putts. And that's super important in the momentum of your matches. I'd rather have somebody that's maybe a little poorer on ball striking, but can make some putts. They're going to do a lot for you. On the other side of it as well, another W, Lee Westwood, huge amount of experience. He's got some form of late. Again, you know, you can't replace experience when it comes to matches. I mean, getting up there and being to be comfortable on that first tee, being comfortable in that environment. And if the coach, you know, gives you that tap on the shoulder and sends you out in singles in an important position. I mean, if you're a rookie and you've never done it before, that's a tough spot to be in, especially with your whole, you know, everybody relying on you. So, you know, you can't beat having a guy like Westy around, and you know, he's going to be fun in the room as well. And just like you're talking about.
I agree. I Lee Westwood, I have concerns about right now. This is a sidebar conversation, and maybe next week we'll go over most concerned when the tour does return of what they got up to on this break. And Lee Westwood is up there tied for number one with our other boy from England, and you know exactly who I'm talking about. These boys like to get into their wine, we'll wait for next week. Let's go over that next week. I think it's a fun little game. Most concerned.
So, yeah, you almost have to think, I mean, who's going to need the longer drying out period before the tour gets back going? I mean, you think about it right now. I mean, with the players all off, I mean, you know, maybe they're not working out as much. They're having a few more beverages, you know, watching a little bit too much Netflix, eating a little bit too much. So, I mean, certainly some players are going to need to round into form, and it might take a little longer for some of them to round into form. Just like you said, Westwood might be enjoying it a little bit too much.
Absolutely. Okay, I'm going to go over my next two picks. The first pick is the least sexy pick of all time, Webb Simpson. He's just a grinder in a weird way, you know. Nate, if when you think of guys that hit shanks on tour, Webb Simpson is like the first name that everyone thinks of. He just hits shanks all the time. Picked up a US Opens, done this Ryder Cup thing before, been playing amazing of late. So he's just got to be on my team just for that reason. And then Patrick Reed's my other pick. I went back and forth whether I wanted Patrick Reed on this team.
Yeah.
But, you know, the stats don't lie. This guy just wins. He gets people fired up. Whether you like him as a person, I guarantee a lot of guys enjoy playing with him at the Ryder Cup just because of the excitement he brings to it. So just Patrick, I hated it. I hated the pick. I went back and forth between him and someone, you know, off like Kevin Na. So there's a hint. Kevin Na did not make my team, but Patrick Reed is my next pick with Webb.
Yeah, and I think we talked about that a few weeks ago, and the fact that sometimes you've got to separate the character of the person and what they can do from a playing perspective, and you know, trying to not include them on there is probably not a wise idea. So, all right, I'll take a kind of an odd pick here for my next one. Somebody who's doing well on the European Tour, has been over to play a couple of majors now, and not still well known yet. He's really establishing himself in the game. Is Robert McIntyre, the lefty from Scotland. a part of the reason why I took him, even though he is more of a, you know, we'll call him a novice type player. He's just sort of getting into it. He's got a lot of match play experience. He won a Scottish Amateur in 15 and 16, also was a Walker Cupper as well. So again, those types of experiences and knowing that you play a lot of match play in Scotland, you grew up playing in match play. So I think that lends itself well, even though he doesn't have that worldwide experience that maybe some of my other team members would at this point.
I like it. Give us two more picks.
All right. We'll go with Thomas Peters, the Belgian bomber. I mean, he's not been doing as great lately, but you know what? He's a four-time winner on the European Tour. He can really move the ball out there, which is going to be an advantage, and you can definitely make use of that during pairings, especially, you know, taking advantage of par fives, alternate shots, having shorter shots into some of the par fours. The other side of it as well is that he played super well in 2016 at the Ryder Cup. He was 4-1-0 there, so he's got that behind him. Another sentimental pick to follow, Graham McDowell, again, rebirthing his game a little bit. Putting has kind of come back from him. You know, he's basically regained a lot of form. I mean, he's about, you know, he's in the mid-20s as far as the European Tour rankings are so right now. But again, experience, he's been on four winning teams, 15-9 record. He's 3-1-0 in singles the last time out. So I think he's a guy you can lean on. And hey, he's a major champion as well. So he knows about pressure and winning at Pebble Beach. You know, it might not correlate to Whistling Straits, but certainly he's a good guy to have in the team room as well.
Also might be on my list next week. Just going to point that out.
Yeah.
All right. I'll give you my next two. Xander Schauffele is my next one. This guy should have been on the team last time around. They went with Tony Finau. Xander was playing great all year. They had a bunch of Tony Finaus on that team, a bunch of bombers. I love Xander's game. I think he's feisty, underrated feisty in a lot of ways, gets fired up. You know, you don't fire your dad as a caddy and not be a feisty guy. So Xander Schauffele, I'm all for. And this guy's got swag, too. I think he'd look good in that USA gear. And then my next pick is Kevin Kisner. This guy just screams American to me. Likes to hunt, likes to fish, loves to play golf, loves to drink beer. And he's amazing putter. And as we said, he might be the shortest guy on both of our lifts by a long shot. Just looking over these names, I don't see anyone that hits it shorter. But still, the putter, that's all that really matters a lot of times in these match play events. I think no one would be more proud of all these guys to make it on the team. So Kevin Kisner is my 10th pick.
Yeah, I mean, if Patrick Reed's known as Captain America, Kisner could probably be General America. You're right. He is an Americana type guy. And, you know, while Patrick Reed might split the crowd, even if they are Americans, you know, everybody's going to be cheering for Kisner, especially in Wisconsin at an American site. That's going to be a big one for him. All right, I'll throw my last three at you, and then you can give me your last two, including your big secret one that you've got labeled there. I guess you're trying to hold that one from me. But I went sentimental for my last three picks. And, you know, even though they're sentimental on the fact that, you know, they've performed well before, they have been showing some form. And I think, again, experience is really, really important. Paul Casey, he's been on three winning teams. He's my number 10 pick. Again, a guy I think that you can depend on. We've talked greatly about him on this podcast. We like him almost every time that a major shows up. You know, he may not be the guy that's always going to win it, but he's a guy who's going to be in there, and he's always going to be in form, in some good form. He's not going to really lose things for you. The other side, Henrik Stenson, another guy, big, strong, can do a lot of things for you. I mean, there's not really a better ball striker that's out there. I mean, this guy really compresses the golf ball. Major champion as well, which is really important. And I think that's going to be really key when we're talking about Whistling Straits and a venue there where it's pretty windy along the lake. I think having this guy who's got that experience of the winning the Open and can, you know, flight the golf ball, I think that's really great that way. Last pick for me, 2012 Medina hero, Ian Poulter. I mean, he fires up a team. Again, his form might not be the greatest right now, but I know he's working hard in the gym. The Ryder Cup probably means more to him than it does to a lot of other people. So I think that's really key for him. And, you know, I think as well that, you know, he's a guy that, you know, the other side will pay a lot of attention to, and he can be a little bit of a distraction as well to the American team and the American fans. So I definitely want to have him on there.
I like that team. So just to go over your team one last time, we got Tommy Fleetwood, John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, Tyrell Hatton, Danny Willett, Lee Westwood, Robert McIntyre, Tomas Peters, Graham McDowell, Paul Casey, Mr. Forearms, Henrik Stenson, and Ian Poulter.
You got it.
All right. So my last two, I'm actually, you know what? I'm going to read off my first 10, give you my 11th, and then my 12th. So as I mentioned off the top, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson is my second pick. Dustin Johnson followed by Brooks Koepka in that order because I know it would drive Brooks crazy. Ricky Fowler, then Justin Thomas, Webb Simpson, Patrick Reed, Xander Schauffele, Kevin Kisner. Now, my 11th pick, this guy screams Ryder Cup to me. He hasn't been playing that great in recent years. For a long time, he was right up there, and then they kind of banned the long putter and then kind of fell off a little bit, but I can't keep him off my team. Keegan Bradley, this guy just, he bombs it, A, to start. B, he's going to fire up. Nobody, I don't think, you know, you say Patrick Reed cares.
Nobody else is jacked to play like he is.
Yeah, he just gets fired up. He can't stand still. He got those feet going. He always has great shoes at the Ryder Cup. Keegan Bradley, he's going to bring a lot to the room. People are going to love this. So,
and you know, if Michael Jordan shows up to watch, which he will, he'll bring some new kicks for Keegan, right?
Oh yeah. MJ is my assistant captain. I think he'll take my call when I call him, considering I'm American and everything. And my final pick and how I would announce this, we're going to get just music going. People are going to get fired up. No one's expecting, imagine smoke. I want lasers. And all of a sudden you see the original Captain America come out. Anthony Kim comes out of retirement to join the Ryder Cup. I tell him immediately this is happening so he can go train. We've seen videos of his golf swing. He's got the tattoos. He's got the long hair. People are going to go nuts. This guy could lose every single point. I don't even care. Just that announcement. He's got the belt buckle out there. Anthony Kim comes back out of retirement, leads the USA team to to a Ryder Cup win. I'm so fired up even thinking about this. And that is it. Everyone's back. He's back, baby. He doesn't care about the insurance money. He just won the Ryder Cup. And he returns to finish off the career we all wanted to see. Anthony Kim, the 12th pick for the Ryder Cup.
Well, you know what? If that's going to happen, I got to give people what they want. The singles match has got to be Rory AK.
Oh, absolutely.
Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think that'd be it. So
final match, Rory AK. I hate to break it to you. Once an AK has been announced, the U.S. team is sweeping it. First time ever. Can't wait for this. Can't wait till till they call me to name these picks in the future. That is our Ryder Cup breakdown. I hope everyone enjoyed that. Please pass on some feedback on our teams. If there's anyone you feel we should have had, shoot us a message on Twitter or on Instagram. We'd love to hear it. Let's grab a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to hit the mailbag, and then we're going to hit the tip of the week because, you know, we're inside. We need something to do, right? So Scotty's going to hit us up with another tip. This break is brought to you by TaylorMade Sim, featuring the Sim driver designed with an entirely new head shape to make the driver both fast and forgiving where you need it most, the downswing. Sim irons with an improved speed bridge and echo dampening system to deliver a distance iron with forge-like feel, and the Sim fairway woods with low CG to help you hit it higher, and a V-steel sole to launch it easier from any lie. Visit TaylorMadeGolf.ca to learn more about the all-new Sim family. All right, Scotty, it's time for the mailbag. As you heard earlier, Doug answered a couple from the mailbag, but we have three more. So, Scott, why don't you open up the mailbag? Tell me what you have.
All right. One of our listeners wants to know what accessory is a must have for your golf bag. So I think the premise here is that basically, you know, what's the priority? I mean, if you're going to have something that's in your golf bag, maybe you've got a small one or something like that. What do you got to have in there? What's the one accessory that you need?
Let's go with here. So I'm gonna set up what is going to be in the golf bag already, because they're obvious. You're gonna have tees, you're gonna have balls, you're gonna have your clubs,
yeah,
you have your glove. Those things you need, right? So these are things that you could get by without, but you might need. I'm gonna say a towel is not a must have. It's a need. Like, it's something that's gonna be on.
I agree.
So that being said, with all of that, I'm actually gonna go with the brush. I'm taking a brush, and I know, you know, people might chirp this. I got some big news for a lot of people. Pretty much every player on the tour, in their bag, there's a brush somewhere. Secret of the tour pros.
The dirty secret.
Yeah. And you never see it. It's always like, it's pretty funny. I notice this quite often. It's never hanging outside the bag. It's hanging inside the bag. It's in there, but you'll never actually see it. To the point where during my first round caddying, I actually asked, am I allowed to use this? Because I didn't know if it was like some rule. So based on that, there are times where that you're just scrubbing and scrubbing with the towel. It may be soaking wet. You just can't get that one piece of dirt or something out. So give me that brush. I'm taking out that dirt no matter what.
Yeah. You know, I had to think about a few things on this. I thought for a while it was going to be laser range finder, but you know, I don't really need one of those. I've had one in the bag for like 17 years, but you know what? The accessory that I like the most that a lot of people don't have, but I tend to like just because I practice a lot, is just sort of those artificial putting cups. They're basically just a putting disc. And I just like to have them in the bag for, you know, just when I'm practicing on the putting green, just to like set up a cup wherever I want and practice that way. So an odd one, I know for sure. A lot of manufacturers kind of make them, but it's just something that never leaves my bag. I don't know. It's not something I see a lot of other people have, but it's something that I use a lot.
I think the rangefinder is more, it's crazy. I think it's more of the must have in a lot of ways.
True. Yeah, probably.
That you can figure things out. The problem is, I guess it depends on the course. Like if I go to a course and I look at, and they're like, hey, we don't have a yardage book, we got no GPS system, things like those type of things, then yeah, if it comes down to the brush or the rangefinder, I'm getting the rangefinder. But let's assume you have your yardages, then it's an actual small accessory. It's got to be the brush, but you know, you got to know how far to hit it. So I don't know.
Yeah, for sure.
Tough call.
All right. Looking for a small walking bag, this listener says, what are some options to look at? Do you have a favorite for some of the walking bags and stuff that are out there?
Oh, I mean, every brand does a good one nowadays. I think certain brands like Ping, everyone knows they're really small hoofer bags, been around forever. I know TaylorMade's been trying to get in that market as well, and I've actually had a TaylorMade bag a couple times that's nice and light, good for carrying. Sun Mountain makes a good bag. Every brand makes a really good bag.
Yeah,
that being said, like if it depends what you're looking for. Like I know you and I have played 10 rounds together, and all I've ever seen you have is a Sunday bag. So clearly if it's a good quality leather bag in your case, which it is, then I think that will do just fine. I have no idea what brand it is.
Yeah, it's a Jones bag. So they make some good, what you'd call a Sunday bag. Pretty slim, just has a few pockets in there, sort of all that you need. Stitch has got some new ones out as well. There's another company a lot of people probably have never thought of. And you mentioned TaylorMade. There's actually a new bag from them, which is sort of going back a ways. If you think about some of the original, one of the original bags that they made had a little kickstand that basically, instead of a big full stand, it was just like a short stand. It was like everybody used to call it like a grasshopper bag. Sun Mountain had one as well, but they actually have that coming back this year. So it's got legs that are maybe, I don't know, 10, 12 inches long, and they're up near the top. So it's just like a Sunday bag, but it has a little bit of a leg just to prop it up, keep it off the ground. And I think that style will probably come back a little bit as well.
There you go.
All right, last question here. There is some discussion. Phil Mickelson sort of fueled the flames here a little bit, talking on Twitter about the possibility of a second match between him and Tiger Woods. Who knows what the format could be? Obviously, people are speculating what it could be. This was talked about when the original match was on. Are you interested in a Phil-Tiger rematch?
Yeah, my understanding of this is that these guys signed on for three matches. So this is just the next logical step. I'm also hearing with this one in particular, there's talks of partners, and, mm-hmm. and I heard Tom Brady and Peyton Manning. I almost said Phil Mickelson. He'll be there. Yeah. Tom Brady and Peyton Manning as being the potential partners for this. The answer, if I'm interested in it, is when. A, if it's tomorrow, if there's another sport that comes out prior, my interest comes way lower. But at this point, I'm missing professional sports where I don't know the outcome in it. Yep. I actually think it gets worse if you bring somebody like Tom Brady and Peyton Manning in, because I think the competition level goes way down. I get both of them are good golfers, but it's just for sponsorship money at that point. I'd watch it regardless at this point. I think we need something, but
if it was, you're talking about Brady and Manning, but let's say it's Steph Curry and Tony Romo. Would that kind of hype it up a little bit more just because they're more skilled players?
No, it could be Bill Murray and Donald Trump out there. It does not matter to me who the other two are. If these two are playing each other, I want them playing each other on their own dime and not a gimmicky end like they did last time. Like, let's actually do a good match. Mic them up the whole time. Let's hear it. Mic up the caddies. Let's make it done right. However, right now, I don't think that makes sense. Like, if they're going to do it now, I think the only way you can really do it is mic both them up, have one camera guy out there, maybe two camera guy or gal out there, and do what you can. Would I pay for that, though? Like, that's the other thing. Like, am I really going to pay for a one still camera, no shot tracker? Who knows? But at this point, I say all this. If it comes out, if this comes out in 2 weeks and they're not doing it, like, I'm probably watching it because I just miss sports.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm in the same boat. I mean, if it comes out later on when maybe things come back to normal a bit and there's all the other sports going on, I think the biggest interest for me at that point, I'd still want to see these guys playing for their own money. That would be probably the biggest interest. Knowing that they're playing for another sponsor prize or anything doesn't really do it. I mean, these guys are obviously made a lot of money in their career. If they were digging into their own pockets, that would probably ramp it up for me, but otherwise probably not a lot of interest.
Or even like do it like something different instead of money like that you actually can see. So you and I think, joked about this at one point. Let's say they play for the other guy has to be the other guy's caddy for a week. And it's an actual PGA Tour tournament. And Tiger, I would love if Tiger lost it, though. Like, that would be way funnier.
And had to loop.
That would be way better than if Phil lost it, because I feel like Phil would take it better. Tiger would hate looping for Phil. And can you imagine if it came down and, like, Phil was actually close to, like, winning the tournament and there's Tiger carrying his bag beside... That's entertainment. Give me that.
Now, would you, I mean, ideally that would be cool if it was on a PGA Tour event, but how good would that be for the Korn Ferry Tour if those two guys went and played a Korn Ferry Tour event and were doing the opposite looping sort of thing? That could be interesting too.
It could be. And that would bring fans out to the Korn Ferry Tour event. The only problem with that is that's a no-win situation for those guys. If, who knows, Dave blah 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 beats Phil by like 50.
Yeah, that's true too.
And then it's like Phil misses the cut on the Korn Ferry Tour event, and it's all like, then those debates come out. I don't see those guys doing
and
that
no for money for Tiger then if he misses.
Yeah, and I don't see any of those guys doing it for their pride and their egos. So as fun as that would be, I don't see that being I don't see it happening. But just give me something different than money, because the money is going to get backed from somewhere else, where like Tiger spending a week carrying Phil's bag.
Yeah.
You can't fake that.
Yeah, you're right. I think you're right. It's got to have some other consequence that's maybe not monetary, because, that might not mean that much to them at this point. So may as well make it something that's hinging on their pride.
Exactly. Well, that was the mailbag, I guess, for the week. We do have a tip of the week. We heard a couple from Doug earlier, but I think we've been talking about things to do inside with golf clubs. I think one of the big things, at least for me, is I've just been sitting and laying and lazing around. We need to do something else, because once I'm actually able to hit golf clubs, I don't even know my muscles and bones will work. So what tips do you have to, get your body ready to hit golf clubs again if that time does come?
Yeah, I guess that's one big thing. Do something. That's the biggest thing more than anything. And you know, this is giving us a lot more opportunities right now. There's a lot more options to look at online, especially. And if you look at a website like MyTPI, for an example, which specializes in golf exercises, you can go to a website like that. There's a whole lot of routines and exercises that you can learn that can get your body moving, can do a lot of things that just require body weight more than anything. You don't necessarily need a gym to be able to do it. And there's a lot of golf related exercises. So that would be something for you to check out right now. And as I said, just do something. And, you know, really this is your opportunity to really set up your body for your golf game. So, you know, you might not do it all the time because you get busy with playing the game and you're hitting balls. This is your opportunity to take care of your body first and take advantage of the many opportunities, especially with online webinars, instruction, videos, everything that's available for you right now.
Yeah, I got to start doing something. I was joking off air. There was, you know, pre-quarantine Stefan, and now there's post with, you know, couple extra pounds. I'm going to be telling people I'm still carrying a little bit of quarantine weight still in October at this point. It's not looking good. That being said, you can change that. You just got to start. So tomorrow I'm starting, that's for sure. Scotty, appreciate the tip. Appreciate Doug for coming on and chatting junior golf and some basketball amongst all other things. We're going to break down a tournament next week. So if anyone has any suggestions, shoot it over to us on Twitter or on Instagram. And we'll break down our thoughts on that tournament next week, because we are going to do that. And we're going to break down our top five players we're most worried about coming out of quarantine at some point next week, which should be fun. So can't wait for that. Until then, everyone stay safe, stay inside, and we'll see you next week. Like today, my boat's lost in the ocean.